to the What Bitcoin Did podcast.
Hello, how are you all? Welcome to the third episode of the What Bitcoin Did podcast. I am your host, Peter McCormack, and I am a full-time Bitcoin and crypto trader, blogger, podcaster, and soon-to-be miner. Yes, I am now going into the mining game. I've been looking at it for a while. I've been talking about it with my buddy Chad, and I have finally bought my first bunch of mining gear. So this is going to be delivered at the end of January, and hopefully we'll be having it set up by February. I have been sharing all the details about this with my Facebook group, why I'm going to be doing it, and I will probably be sticking some articles about it up on my website. I've gone into it for a couple of reasons. Firstly, I've got super busy with the podcast and the website, so I wanted a way of hedging my investing and actually mining Bitcoins rather than just trying to buy them and sell them at a profit. And secondly, just to increase my knowledge. You know, by being involved in Bitcoin mining, I will understand it a bit more. So yes, I will share more information about this in the future. So in the first two podcasts, I interviewed crypto traders, and I don't want to do this every week. I think it could get a bit repetitive asking the same questions, but also I think as traders, it's really important we understand the market we're trading in. So I want to meet as many different and interesting people in the space that we can learn from so we can broaden our knowledge and have a deeper level of understanding of how blockchain and crypto works. And in this third episode, I've got another gem. I feel really lucky to do this because I've got a Bitcoin badass, Mr. Jameson Lopp. He first came on my radar during the scaling debate, something which at times I struggle to understand, but he kept popping up on Twitter when the key kind of leading figures within Bitcoin were discussing the scaling issues. And he always came across as someone super intelligent, and the points he made were ones that swayed me to understanding the philosophical reasons for wanting small blocks. But he also stuck out for another reason. If you check out his Twitter profile, he's got a huge beard, he's got a Make Bitcoin Great Again cap, he's smoking a cigar, and then he's got the odd tweet where he's firing out guns. So he just came across as this kind of really interesting dude with a really good following and a really good philosophical approach to what Bitcoin is. And so I wanted him on the podcast. I emailed him. He said, yep, he's up for doing it. I agreed I would fly over and see him here in North Carolina. But I didn't just want to do the interview with him. The thing with the guns kind of stood out for me in that I don't really understand guns. I don't really like them. There's a clear correlation between guns and shootings in the US, but at the same time, I felt like there was some kind of link between gun ownership and the right to do this and what that meant to Jameson, but also then the financial freedoms of Bitcoin. I don't talk to him about guns in the podcast. It was something I talked to him about a lot offline during the day, but he agreed to take me to a gun range to show me, you know, what it's about and actually let me fire a gun. Like I said, I'd never shot one and I was quite nervous, but it was a really interesting experience. Both listened to him talking about guns and what they mean to him, but also in going to the range, handling a gun myself, shooting one, and meeting and talking to the people there. And it wasn't an experience I expected at all. When I was talking to the people there, what I realized is that guns are a part of the fabric of their life. You know, people walk around with guns every day. People, you know, one guy I think told me he owned 30 guns, another guy said he had 40 guns. For them, owning a gun and learning how to hold a gun and shoot one is no different from in the UK for someone learning to drive and owning a car in terms of what it means to them. You know, when I leave the house and I grab my keys and my phone and my wallet, for these people I spoke to, the gun is just another part of that list. And I'm not validating this. I'm not saying guns are good. What I wanted to do was just understand what it meant for these people. And you know, it was a weird experience. You know, the room we went into to shoot the guns, it kind of felt in some ways like a bowling alley in that we had these lanes which were for us, and when you looked around, there were a wide variety of people. Next to us was an old couple in their 70s. There were two young lads together. There was a guy and his pregnant wife. There was another guy on his own who was there before we got there, and it was carried on after we'd gone. And I guess, you know, the best thing I can compare it to is like a bowling alley. It was just entertainment for these people. But at the same time, gun ownership has a serious meaning to them. And, you know, it wasn't what I expected at all, as because I guess I felt like guns were like they are in the film. They just fire and, you know, they just shoot bullets. But actually, the experience of hearing one and holding one is entirely different from what I expected. They're so much more powerful. They are really loud. And they are kind of scary. So, I mean, I would be lying if I said I didn't enjoy the experience. But I'm not sure how much I'd want to do it again in the future. I definitely don't want to own one. I definitely don't want guns in England. If it was up to me, they would be banned everywhere and they'd be gone. They do cause too much damage to society. And even talking to Jameson, he accepts the correlation between the number of guns owned and shootings. But owning a gun is a part of the Constitution and is a part of their freedom. And understanding this and spending the day with him talking and understand this helped me understand him as a person better and helped me understand what Bitcoin means more to him, because everything to him is about freedom. Everything is about protecting yourself from the state. Everything is about protecting yourself from others. An entirely different experience from what I've lived growing up. So look, I apologize for the long interview. You know, if you look on my Twitter or my Facebook, I've posted up photos and videos from the experience. I'm not miserable doing it. I'm clearly enjoying myself. But I thought it was worth explaining why I wanted to speak to Jameson and why I wanted to have the full day with him, because it helped me understand him better as a person. You know, outside of this, he's absolutely dedicated to Bitcoin and helping others. If you go and check out his website, it's full of helpful advice. And the night before the interview, he actually invited me along to a meetup he'd organized with Jimmy Song, who was doing a presentation on the three anti-fragilities of Bitcoin. I'm not sure what he made of me. I think he is used to much more intellectual, deep debates about Bitcoin tech and philosophical arguments. And I was there trying to get him to help me help you understand the technical sides of Bitcoin, because one of the reasons for so much success and so much growth is the amount of people coming into the market. But most of us just don't really understand what SegWit is, what Lightning Network is, what blocks are, and how it all works. And I wanted to speak to somebody like him to help that get across. So, like I said, I'm not sure what he thought about me, but I am really grateful for him. He was very warm and hospitable. He gave me a whole of his day, and he gave me a deeper understanding of Bitcoin. But conversely, I've come out of this realizing how little I do know and how much more I do need to understand. So I'm going to be going through his website, going through the resources and making sure I continue to understand as much as I can. And I suggest you do the same. I will share all the important links to the things I found from him, articles and interviews and specific things I think we should all take time to read. So yes, again, apologize for the long intro, but I thought it was worth explaining why I spent the day with him and the things we did. And look, as per previous weeks, if you want to help the show, there's a few things you can do, and I do appreciate everyone who's helped so far. So firstly, look, if you haven't subscribed to the show on iTunes, please do. The show will appear there before it appears on the website. So as soon as it's uploaded, you will get a notification on your phone within the podcast that you can download it. Also, if you like the show, you think it deserves it, please go and give it a 5-star review on iTunes, because it helps us within the listings. You can also follow me on Twitter or Instagram. My handle is at WhatBitcoinDid on both of them, and feel free to reach out to me. You can also check out my website and sign up to the newsletter. The website address is www.whatbitcoindid.com. And finally, please do share the show with your friends on social media. As I mentioned last week, I'm always looking to meet new and interesting people. I would go anywhere. I just want to get a broad spectrum of people on the show so we can all increase our knowledge. So if you want to be on it or you know anyone you think will be good for the show, please do get in touch. Okay, I think I've spoken enough. That's quite a long intro, so I apologise. But look, I really hope you enjoy the show, and I really hope you enjoy everything Jameson has to say. As ever, I always welcome feedback. Okay, thank you. Jameson, hi. Thank you for having me here in your home in North Carolina. Most of the people who subscribe to my podcast aren't really techies, so to have somebody with the technical background you have is great. And so could you just give us first a background about how you got involved in tech and then Bitcoin and your engineering background?
Sure. So I have been a tech guy since I got my first computer when I was in probably fifth grade. And, my parents were always having to pry the keyboard out of my fingers and, you know, shut down the internet and do anything they could to try to get me to go outside and play like a normal kid. So I've always been interested and fascinated by the internet and just the ability to, you know, project your will out, you know, into cyberspace and learn, really absorb as much information as you can. And that really resulted in me, once I got to a university, looking at all my various options and, you know, checking and crossing all of the majors off the list, and the only thing that was left was computer science. So did a computer science degree here at UNC Chapel Hill, and got right out into the real world and started working for an online marketing company, just doing a lot of statistical analysis, really changing what I was doing with tech over the years as the technology evolved, and became more and more of a back-end engineer, like working on really low-level stuff. So after I was doing that for 5 or 6 years, I eventually heard about Bitcoin. I don't even remember, like, there was no aha moment for me. I'm sure I heard about it a number of times and dismissed it. And then eventually something came along, probably on Slashdot in 2012. And I said, okay, you know, this thing is not going away. Maybe I should look into it. And once I did, I realized, you know, it's actually a very elegant system, solves some interesting problems. And really from there, I just started diving down the rabbit hole, as many people tend to do, especially if they've got the technical chops. So started doing my own projects, forked the Bitcoin Core software, and added in a bunch of metrics logging. That turned into what you can now see at statoshi.info, really just sort of a operational dashboard of like Bitcoin Node. And did a number of other projects over the years, eventually to the point where in 2014, 2015, you know, there was a lot of venture capital flowing into the space. And I realized, you know, I was spending so much time thinking about Bitcoin and learning about it that I might as well try to just get paid to do it so that I didn't have to do my day job and do the Bitcoin stuff. So I've been working at BitGo for nearly 3 years now, and have been progressing along as the company is growing there. And now I'm leading a team of four different back-end infrastructure engineers, basically building the really low-level stuff at BitGo that helps us like keep track of all the blockchain data and do the actual cryptographic key signing. Really all the functionality that the rest of our engineers can then build our wallet and our platform and SDKs on top of.
Okay, and on your website, you talk about being a cypherpunk or aligning yourself with the kind of philosophical viewpoint of a cypherpunk. Can you kind of explain what that is to the rest of us who wouldn't know or wouldn't understand that?
Sure. So back in the 1980s, a bunch of nerds who were getting really interested in this internet thing that was getting developed, they saw the potential for the internet and the technologies that were going to be built on top of it. They also saw the potential for misuse by nation states and, you know, basically, you know, creation of surveillance societies. And they realized that we need to have strong privacy, preferably by default, when we're using these new technologies. Otherwise, they're just going to get co-opted by governments and agencies and even private companies, you know, to just suck up all of our data and strip all of our privacy away. And I think we've seen, you know, over the decades, that has become the norm where people have very little privacy, at least online, and they seem to be okay with it. They don't really think about it that much. So the cypherpunks, they were focused on building privacy-enhancing technologies, so that resulted in things like PGP, which was, you know, for email encryption, and a lot of other cryptographic protocols that get used on a day-to-day basis now by most people, you know, just under the hood when they're using the internet. And one of the sort of side projects that a number of people did was try to create digital money. And I don't even know how many projects there were, but probably dozens of different projects over the years that ended up crashing and burning, and people kept trying and failing. And then, you know, after the 90s, it really slowed down. I think like DigiCash went under in the late 90s, and nobody really was trying to do digital money anymore. And then sort of out of nowhere in 2008, this Satoshi Nakamoto figure appears on the Cypherpunks mailing list and says, "Hey, I think I figured it out." And actually the initial reaction from most of the cypherpunks was twofold. It was either sort of feigning disinterest of like, look, everybody's tried these things, it's not going to work, you shouldn't bother with it. Or it was active, you know, this is why it's not going to work. These are specific reasons why your system is going to fail. And so really there were only one or two people that responded positively to it. And one of those was Hal Finney. He really saw the potential of the system, and he and Satoshi started working together, and they fixed a lot of bugs. And then eventually, you know, a few months later, the first software got released, and Bitcoin was born, you know, on January 3rd, 2009.
How important do you think privacy is, and the counter argument that government sometimes needs surveillance to protect us? So, for example, in the news this week in the UK, we've heard of 9 terrorist plots that have been foiled, one including to assassinate our prime minister. Mm-hmm. So there is a counter argument. How do you feel about that as an argument?
Right. So, you know, the argument is we can take everybody's privacy away and then nothing bad will happen because we can stop people from doing bad things. That is an extreme trade-off to make, because then ultimately the question comes down to like power and trust, right? Is if you're stripping away everybody's privacy and somebody, some entity is then going to ingest and analyze all of this data, probably some government intelligence agency, then, you know, what happens when there are bad actors at that agency? What happens when they start misusing all of the data? You know, how are they held accountable? And then I think ultimately you'll hear people say, oh, well, other government agencies will hold them accountable. But, you know, eventually the buck has to stop somewhere, and there's going to be some, you know, single executive authority at the top of this hierarchy that, you know, becomes the single, like, trusted point of failure where they can basically screw over everybody because of the power that they've amassed.
And then if you relate this back to Bitcoin and money and management of money and management of wealth, do you think that's one of the primary reasons Bitcoin's been successful, because of privacy?
I think it's really more about the sound money aspects of having a set of rules that the users are agreeing to. Really, Bitcoin has terrible privacy properties at this point. They're going to get better, but it's going to be a long road. So while, you know, in 2011, 2012, Silk Road, darknet markets, all of that stuff was really what helped bootstrap the system. And it was because a lot of these users were saying, oh, it's great, you know, private money, and you can do illegal things with it. It wasn't that you could do illegal things with it because of privacy properties, but rather because of the permissionless, you know, non-authoritarian aspects of it. Like, there was no middleman who could censor your payments. Like, that's why the darknet markets were able to rise so much. We then later found out that, you know, actually government agencies can get in there and do a lot of analysis and try to track people down. So the privacy aspects are not that great. You know, we have better technologies now, like Monero and Zcash. And, you know, I think we're going to see stuff like confidential transactions eventually get into Bitcoin, or, you know, Mimblewimble is something I'm very interested in. So there's a lot of people working on that, but that is not the fundamental value proposition of the system, I think, to most people. I think it's the sound money aspects of, you know, money is this abstract concept. And this is one of the reasons I got into Bitcoin, is because I feel like money is something that is owned by humanity in general, because it is this mutual agreement. We all have to agree upon the properties of the money that we're using to exchange value with each other. So why would you want a money that is basically dictated by a handful of people who are operating behind closed doors, you know, whether that be a few bankers or a few government authorities? Like, why should they have all that power when now we have the ability to create a system where everyone who wants to can give their input, and everyone who wants to can choose what rules they want their money to follow, and then enforce them with, you know, as little as a Raspberry Pi, you know, running at home.
And you mentioned the Silk Road and the dark web networks and e-commerce stores. How important do you think Silk Road was in the success of Bitcoin? Do you think it would have been a success without it, or do you think it was a real driving force?
I think it gave us a big boost. It was the killer app of Bitcoin in the early days. It showed that Bitcoin cryptocurrencies enable types of economic interaction that are not really possible outside of those systems, because nobody can stop you from, you know, transacting in the way that you want to on these systems.
And do you see Ross Ulbricht then as some kind of hero, or do you agree that you could be, you should be able to create a dark web where you can sell anything?
Yeah. You know, my perspective is that Ross Ulbricht is a software engineer who was providing a software service. And some people may have used that for bad things, but I don't think that the you know, moral culpability of other people using his system makes him a bad person. I don't think there's like a transitive property, you know, of bad things, because I'm sure that there are people who use software that I've written and use it to do bad or illegal or immoral things, and that doesn't like transfer to me as a person. Now, you know, you can get into all the legal aspects of, you know, oh, he tried to have people killed and all this other stuff. And, you know, that was actually a huge setup, corrupt government agents that coerced him into doing that stuff. And, you know, he never got charged for it. But it is terrible to see that, you know, he may be locked up for his entire life for nonviolent crimes.
Some people would argue that the Silk Road enabled violent crimes, but at the same time, what then is the difference between the Silk Road and Google and Facebook, where you can find illegal and terrible things through Google, yeah, and you can act on illegal and terrible things through WhatsApp and Facebook? So fundamentally, is there a difference?
Yeah, I mean, I think each person is only responsible for, you know, what they themselves are doing and, you know, directly causing harm to other people. You know, when you start getting into this, oh, you're indirectly causing harm because of someone else who's causing harm, you could then get into the whole like 6 degrees of separation thing and say, oh, well, we're all Hitler then, right?
You know? All right, so what is the real Bitcoin?
The real Bitcoin is whatever you are running software to enforce the rules that you are agreeing to. So the real Bitcoin is whatever you believe it is. Now, what is the real Bitcoin in terms of like global Bitcoin usage? That's a lot harder to define. It's this ethereal, you know, mesh overlap of consensus of what everybody is agreeing to. You know, maybe it's like a least common denominator type rule set, because, you know, there are people out there who are running node software, for example, that would accept 20 megabyte blocks on the Bitcoin network, and that's the only thing that they changed. But other than that, they're running, you know, consensus compatible rules with the current main Bitcoin chain. So they are, quote unquote, like in consensus with the main Bitcoin chain. It just so happens that they would also accept other things. So, you know, you could say, you know, consensus is as consensus does, and once you fall out of consensus, you're now on something else, and then we have to argue about whether it's Bitcoin or not.
So you talk about consensus, and most of the people I know involved in Bitcoin now are really just investing and speculators. They don't know or understand what consensus is. So to the average person, the average new person who's hearing about Bitcoin and joining, what does consensus actually mean?
Well, there's human consensus and there's machine consensus. And really, like, the revolutionary thing that, that Bitcoin did from a technical standpoint is figure out how to do a decentralized machine consensus. So that basically means that you can have computers all around the world who all they have to do is install the software, get on the internet, and they automatically start talking to the other computers on the network and exchange data, validate it, and if they're all in agreement that the data is all following all the rules, they're agreeing to the same rules, then they are in consensus. And so that means that from a technical standpoint, like, your node will accept the exact same transactions that the other nodes have accepted, and your node will reject the transactions and blocks that other nodes would reject. So you're running the same rules and essentially, like, mirroring each other in terms of the data and the technical standpoint. But what this is really doing is it's just automating the human consensus, which is what do the humans agree upon, like, should be the properties of a good, sound monetary system. So the humans have some agreement of what they're wanting to see happen. The developers are trying to transcribe that into code that is robust and it works in adversarial conditions. And then the rest of the people out on the network, enterprises, independent node operators, really anybody who wants to participate, can then look at the code, say, yes, the code looks good, I download it, I run it, and we continue on in consensus, you know, potentially changing rules along the way if we agree to it. So it's a very hard thing to define outside of the machine level. Like, we can say, yes, like, these are the technical things that our code is accepting or rejecting, but then the really tricky part is, you know, how do you kind of reach out into the ether and pull these, like, human consensus concepts and rules and transcribe them into, like, real code? That's what a lot of people are arguing about. You know, what should the rules be? How can we change the rules? How do we move forward? And people tend to get really frustrated because some people are more conservative than others about trying to change these rules.
And you often talk about how important nodes are for the network. You encourage people to have a node or to operate a node. A lot of people won't understand what it is or how to do it. So can you explain what a node is and how that differs from a miner? And then we'll probably move on to talking about how that is actually so relevant to the scaling debate.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah. So in order to have the strongest security model in one of these permissionless crypto asset systems, you have to download all of the data, the entire history of transactions and the blockchain of that system, and you have to validate it all. You have to check every piece of data to make sure that no one is breaking the rules, no one is trying to defraud anybody. This is how you get into what you may hear called a trustless state. It's where you are not relying upon anybody being honest to you, because you're getting data from a number of different sources and cross-checking it and validating it. And once you know, get to the latest block and the latest transactions that are happening on the network, you can now be sure that no one has lied to you because you've checked all of the data yourself. So the only way to do that is to run a full node. And at the moment on Bitcoin, you know, you can do this on something as small as a Raspberry Pi, though it will take you a few weeks probably to get it up and running. But really any like decent desktop or laptop that has like a couple hundred gigabytes of hard drive space should be able to run a node just fine. Now, you know, we get into a lot of the scaling debate arguments, and a lot of that comes down to trade-offs of like how much should it cost to run a full node versus how much should it cost to create a transaction and store it on the blockchain. We get into all of these trade-offs and the ideological differences about the best way to continue increasing Bitcoin adoption.
So is it a case of, if you scale by increasing the block size, you make it more difficult and more expensive to run a node.
Mm-hmm.
So you essentially, you are making a more centralized system and therefore more open to individuals or groups taking control of how it should operate. Is that essentially what we're talking about here?
Yeah, I mean, that's what the debate comes down to. And then, you know, qualitatively, I believe that is correct. Then it becomes very tricky to say quantitatively, well, okay, what should the acceptable cost of running a full node be? You know, what is the average person who is tech savvy enough to run a full node? What are they willing to pay? And I ran some polls on this a couple of years ago, and the numbers were pretty low. Like, people did not want to spend more than like $10 or $20 a month to run a full node. Now, you know, depending on whether or not you have your own dedicated machine or you're running it in the cloud, you know, the cost can vary significantly. But I think it was pretty clear that like once you get to the point where it costs more than $100 to run a full node for a month, then only really large enterprises are going to be doing that. And this is scary to a lot of people because, for example, the SegWit2x New York agreement, that was basically a lot of large enterprises saying, okay, we're going to like take the governance of Bitcoin and we're going to change, you know, what the software that our nodes are running, and then we'll have our own little network, and it doesn't matter whether or not, you know, the rest of the Bitcoin network follows us because we have all the economic power. And that failed for a number of reasons, but if Bitcoin was already in a state where they were the only ones who could afford to run a full node, probably would have succeeded.
Okay, so it's interesting. So actually, I want to work through the scaling thing, because when I came into Bitcoin, well, came back at the start of the year, I just came as an investor, and I started to use Reddit as a place to research. And very quickly came across the subreddit of /Bitcoin and the subreddit /BTC. And honestly, it's taken me probably 6 to 7 months to form an opinion and finally realize, actually, I don't like either subreddit, mm-hmm. but I'm definitely a small blocker.
Yeah.
Can you try and help people understand who the two different camps are and how the split came about for people who don't know?
Sure. So I would, you know, there's a lot of obviously minutia in, you know, people having slightly different opinions, but to generalize the quote unquote small blocker versus large blocker, or you could generalize it as off-chain scaling preference versus on-chain scaling preference. The difference here is the trade-offs that people are willing to make. So the people who want to do on-chain scaling, like right now, they have a much higher time preference. Like, they believe that Bitcoin needs to grow in adoption by a huge amount as quickly as possible, you know, get as many people making transactions on the blockchain as possible to capture, you know, as much value as possible, and to give Bitcoin the attributes of what they consider to be a digital cash system, which should be, you know, fast payments, very, very low transaction fees, and preferably just continue working the same way that it has been for a number of years. Now, over the past few years, as adoption has continued to rise, Bitcoin has become more expensive to transact and more difficult to transact. We've run into a lot of issues with congestion and creating fee markets and stuff. And this has frustrated a lot of people who were early adopters, you know, using it back when almost nobody was using Bitcoin, and you could just pay like a one penny transaction fee and get confirmed in the next block, never have any problems.
Actually, I saw that on your website, because I didn't even realize originally the miner fee was a optional contribution.
Yeah.
just for thanking them. You didn't actually have to pay a fee. I didn't really know that.
Yeah, there was also a concept of transaction priority, which was basically looking at the age of the outputs that you were spending. So you could, each block back in the day had something like 10 or 20 kilobytes of space reserved for high priority, zero fee payments. So basically, if you had not spent your Bitcoins in a long time, you could spend them for free and get a prioritized transaction.
Okay,
and that went away, you know, a couple of years ago as the fee market emerged. Now, you know, you have to pay to play, as it goes. So, on the other hand, we have the small blockers or the people who want to do off-chain scaling, which is obviously much more challenging. It's requiring, you know, creating entire new systems that operate as, you know, layers on top of Bitcoin.
And this is with Bitcoin as on-chain as the settlement layer.
Correct.
And this will keep the cost of operating a node down.
Yep.
Which keeps the system more honest. So we're happy with that.
Yeah, so the downside, of course, is that right now in the interim, where the off-chain solutions are not really usable yet, they're still in a really beta phase. Mm-hmm. It means people still have to do everything on-chain, and because so many people are trying to create transactions on-chain, the fees to compete to get in the chain are going up and up and up. And that frustrates a lot of people who would prefer to be able to make Bitcoin payments for small value. So, you know, if you have to pay a $5 transaction fee, it no longer makes sense to send $5 or $10 or $20 even.
These people really are actually that bothered because of the use case they want to use it right now? Or do you think it's an ideological annoyance and actually there's other options while that they can use, you know?
It's both. I think a lot of the loudest people are, you know, first world folks who have access to other payment rails and they could use cheaper options. But there are also plenty of people who are in third world countries that have a terrible currency, you know, Venezuela, Argentina,
Zimbabwe.
Yes. So, and those people, they can't afford to spend, you know, several dollars just on a transaction fee because they're only making, you know, so many dollars a day. So, you know,
but are these people even operating with the technology to use cryptocurrencies, and do they have the ability to transact? I mean, I can see wealth protection in Venezuela and Zimbabwe, but I can't see the average guy using it for daily life yet.
Right. I think they're still mostly using it for a store of value.
Yeah.
But even if they're mostly using it for store of value, if they're incrementally, you know, adding to their wallet like every few days, then they're going to be like building up a lot of tiny value outputs that are then going to be really expensive to spend when they do want to spend it. So, you know, this is very hard to answer because I can see it both ways. Like, yes, I think that everybody in Bitcoin, regardless of their scaling preference, agrees that the long-term goal is for Bitcoin to be usable by everyone, everywhere, for, you know, as low fees as is possible, while still, you know, trying to maintain the rest of the principles of the system that give it so much value in the first place. But
so you think we should just be patient and wait for the right tech?
That's what most of it comes down to.
And what kind of timescale do you think for the right kind of, you know, we're talking Lightning Network. What kind of timescales do you think people should expect this to be something that becomes usable?
I'm expecting Lightning Network to become usable next year. Okay. You know, definitely by the end of next year. I mean, so you can already, quote unquote, use it on the Bitcoin main network right now. It's just the wallet software is still in a very early stage where, you know, you don't want to actually be risking a lot of money doing that. There are a lot of problems that have yet to be completely sussed out or even run into. And, you know, I had a very lengthy article I wrote 2 years ago about all of the problems that we could run into with the Lightning Network. And there are going to be problems because we're building something that has never existed before, and we don't know all of the edge cases, the things that we're going to run into. But the reason that I'm bullish on it is because I have spoken to and met with all of the people who are expending their skills and their resources to building this technology, and they're not going to give up if they run into a problem. They're engineers, they see a problem, and they work on it until they have a solution.
Okay, and because of this scaling debate, we now have this new fork problem, I see, where although it's Bitcoin allows you to create forks, it's the way it is.
It's freedom.
Freedom, but at the same time, I mean, I read this morning about Bitcoin God that's coming out on Christmas Day.
Yeah.
I don't know if you heard about that.
I did.
But this kind, so for me, where this all kind of took shape was with the user activated, was it a soft fork?
Yeah.
Was that Luke Dash Jr. was kind of involved in that?
So I believe that the entity who first really came out publicly and wrote code to do it was Shaolin Fry, okay. Another pseudonymous entity out there, who I believe was also a Litecoin developer.
Okay.
But that was, I think, BIP 148. I think there were a few other BIPs as well, because there are various ways that you can do this. And it's interesting that the user-activated soft fork movement was very interesting sociological phenomenon. The hats from Samson Mao are interesting, like human signaling mechanisms. I've got my hat collection. But it also triggered a lot of folks, got really upset. But mainly the enterprise folks who I guess believe that, you know, they have a bigger claim to Bitcoin and defining what it is than the users.
So on a technical level, it was beyond me to understand it. But what it felt like is that it proved and it validated the need for nodes, and it proved that the users were in charge, not the miners and not the corporations. How did the user activated soft fork actually happen? How do users control this?
Yeah. So whether or not it proved anything is hard to say, because you could argue that the user-activated soft fork for SegWit was quote-unquote averted by SegWit2x. But the whole idea behind it was that the BIP9 activation mechanism, which is something that has been used in Bitcoin to activate soft forks for a number of years, and a soft fork is just a backwards compatible change. That has traditionally used mining hash power to signal when it is safe to activate. So basically, the miners have to put some data into their blocks that says, we are now running software that is going to validate this new consensus rule. And once, you know, like 95% of the past several weeks worth of blocks are all signaling that, then the software says, okay, we are in a safe place where we can activate it and start rejecting anyone who is not validating this new rule. And that worked pretty well. I think, you know, three or four different features were soft fork into the protocol over a few years, and they were not contentious. It was never a problem. But then when we got to our first contentious change with SegWit, the miners realized that they could use this activation mechanism as a veto of sorts, where all they had to do was nothing, and now, you know, the feature doesn't get activated, and they can use it as a bargaining chip to try to say, okay, we want larger block sizes or this or that. And the counter to miners vetoing activation of stuff is users vetoing the miners not activating it.
So they lose their block rewards.
Yeah. So that's what the UASF is. It is the veto of the veto. Of like, if you're not activating this new rule by this time, we are rejecting your blocks. We're not paying you any of your block rewards. And you're going to have to either change or die.
Because you won't be able to pay your power bills at the end of the month.
Exactly.
Interesting. Okay. So from that, we got SegWit, which I don't understand. A lot of people don't understand, but from what I can understand, it was a optimization of the code, taking out something that wasn't really needed. And then we had a couple of things happen. We had Bitcoin Cash come along as a hard fork. Now, I'm not a fan of it. From everything I understand, it is essentially a more complicated PayPal. But I, at the time, respected it as something they wanted to do. So I just want to talk about Bitcoin Cash. And so, do you call it Bcash?
Usually.
And do you call it to defend the Bitcoin name?
Yeah. I say Bcash mostly in text form. You know, when I'm speaking, I'm fine saying Bitcoin Cash. But I think especially in text form and on like websites and web apps, I would prefer to see Bcash just as a disambiguation, because
it kind of sounds cooler than Bitcoin Cash anyway.
Yeah, but at BitGo, we've had so much support and engineering resource consumption due to user confusion of sending Bitcoin to Bcash addresses or vice versa, and basically people just not understanding that these are two completely different incompatible networks.
Okay, so why does Bcash exist? Why do you think it exists?
It's the culmination of frustration by the on-chain scaling movement. And, you know, after several years of not being able to force Bitcoin to change in the way that they wanted, eventually Bitmain funded Amaury Séchet to develop Bitcoin ABC, which at the time, I believe they were calling it a like backup failover option if SegWit2x didn't go through. And then for some reason, they changed their stance on that and they said, you know what, we're doing it anyways, which was, you know, probably a good thing for them because SegWit2x was really screwed up and would have failed if it had actually tried to activate. So the weird thing is, you know, they only gave us like a 2-week notice that they were going to create this new network. And that resulted in a lot of us scrambling and arguing with them because I believe at first they were not going to have replay protection. And so we were screaming at them like, you better have replay protection. And thankfully they added that in. And then, you know, it's been an interesting learning experience because we've learned a few other things now that are going to need to be best practices for these type of hard fork altcoin airdrops. So the address format, for example. So it turns out you can have replay protection, but if you don't make the address format change to be invalid, then people are still going to lose money by, you know, sending coins from one network to an address on the other network, which of course never shows up there because they're just sending them on the wrong network.
Okay, so you called it a movement, but there's really a few players in there that kind of made it happen, and without them it wouldn't have happened. So we're talking Jihan, Roger, a couple of others who seem to be in the background, but those primarily. So I understand the argument for Jihan. Mm-hmm. I understand his argument. Yeah, he's a miner, he's a businessman, he's making money. There's an economic reason for him.
And there may or may not be the ASIC boost issue.
Yeah, may not be. I don't understand the Roger Ver argument so much in that he originally, when I first read Digital Gold, he seemed like just a cool guy who'd done a lot for Bitcoin.
Yeah.
I don't understand. He almost feels like he should have ideologically been on the small block size. So I don't understand what's happened there. Do you have any idea? Do you have any thoughts?
Well, Roger has gotten very frustrated with Bitcoin Core. I guess he has had a lot of interactions with Core developers over the years that have not ended well for him. And so I think in general, he does not like the Bitcoin Core philosophy.
Let's explain who Bitcoin Core are.
Sure. So, you know, from a historical standpoint, Satoshi Nakamoto created Bitcoin and the Bitcoin repository. For a number of years, it was just called Bitcoin or Bitcoin QT. And then sometime around like 2011 or 2012, Mike Hearn and Gavin Andreessen, who were two Bitcoin Core developers at the time, decided that, you know, we needed a better name. And they settled on Bitcoin Core. I think there were a number of protests against that name because, you know, Core is kind of antithetical to a decentralized project. But for whatever reason, that name change went through and it's been called Bitcoin Core ever since. And now it's weird because you hear a lot of FUD from people saying that, oh, Bitcoin Core is a like single authoritarian group of just a few people who are mostly, you know, Blockstream employees and all of this other nonsense, where really Bitcoin Core is an open source code repository that hundreds of people contribute to. I have some minor contributions to it myself. Anybody who wants to can contribute to it. On the other hand, you know, now on the larger block, like Bcash side of things, you've got like Bitcoin Unlimited, Bitcoin XT, Bitcoin ABC. You've got a number of different repositories there. But if you really look at those, like each of those repositories has like two or three developers. So they might appear to be more decentralized. But I think if you look at like terms of total developer power and resources, Bitcoin Core is actually more diverse, more spread out.
And so one of the arguments is that Bitcoin Core may be slow to develop. Mm-hmm. But at the same, the counter argument is actually they're taking the time to make sure there's no fuck ups.
Yeah, I mean, there's no argument that they are conservative. And really, I've been a software engineer for 10 years, pretty much always in the like web app development space. And web app development, software engineering in general, is so different from crypto asset protocol engineering. The closest thing that I can really help to describe crypto asset engineering is more like aerospace engineering, because the tolerances are basically zero. If you fuck up, it's really hard to revert. Like once you get a code change in and it gets deployed out onto the network, because you are not deploying it yourself, it's other people, you know, coming in, downloading it and running it. You don't have the power or the authority to go and push out code fixes to everybody who's running your code.
And I guess, I mean, you know, the price went up again last night. Did we hit nearly $13,000?
I think so.
You know, we're over $200 billion now for Bitcoin. And I think in some ways, what happened, I'm going to jump around a bit here, but what happened post cancellation of SegWit2x and the issue with the Jeff Garz, it kind of proved that actually he did a job at proving the value of Core, because there was a problem with like...
There were several bugs.
Yeah, like very bad bugs that would have essentially fucked up Bitcoin.
Well, so that is specifically a case, and there are very similar cases that happened with Bitcoin Unlimited last year, I believe, where the entire network crashed like four different times because they had less, talented or just developers who had as much experience writing their code, and they had far fewer developers in general on their repository doing the peer review of the code. So these various bugs get introduced into the software gets deployed out onto the network, and then somebody comes along and actually looks at the code and says, oh, look what I found. And then they create a tool in like 30 minutes that can remotely shut down and crash all the nodes on the network. And so this is an interesting kind of juxtaposition, because everybody thinks of Bitcoin as this really strong, robust, anti-fragile system. And that is true for a number of reasons, but the protocol, the code itself, is actually incredibly fragile. You can screw up this protocol by adding one line of code that is, you know, has a bug and is in the wrong place, or is, you know, using an uninitialized variable, or a million things that you can screw up and do wrong to basically create a tiny little chink in the armor of the protocol that then an attacker gets into, exploits, and then they can take the whole thing apart.
Okay, I'm going to come back to the SegWit2x stuff. Just want to go back. So Roger fell out with Core because what, he was trying to get them to do things he wanted?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think most of this really comes down to frustration and time preferences. You know, he correctly saw that the fees on the network are going up, mm-hmm. and that certain use cases were getting priced out of the network. And that was very disturbing to him because, you know, he sees Bitcoin as peer-to-peer digital cash. It should be fast. It should be cheap. He's seeing that the nature of Bitcoin is changing in a way that he does not like. And, you know, he spoke to core developers, I'm sure, many, many times. And the solution that they come up with, you know, off-chain scaling is not something that he's particularly fond of, because he thinks that it's, you know, maybe vaporware or just take way too long to actually get implemented. And he wants to, you know, see evolution happening at a faster pace.
So can you empathize with him at all? And can you philosophically see what he's doing and you know?
Oh, yeah. Because I was a big blocker. I mean, the first real big movement for big blocks, Bitcoin XT, was, you know, a proposal to increase to like 20 megabyte block sizes. Right. And that was like 2 or 3 years ago. And at the time, I had just become a full-time Bitcoin, you know, software engineer at BitGo. And I was like, yeah, you know, we're seeing backlogs and the users are complaining and it's costing more to do stuff. And like, if we just kick the can down the road and like increase the block size by a lot, then yeah, all of these problems will be alleviated for us. And it took me probably most of a year to eventually come around and realize, you know, what the trade-offs of doing something like that would be.
I think that's the thing for most people, because when I first saw it, I was kind of like, well, a big box makes sense.
Yeah.
What, lower fees and it'll be faster. I can be a store of wealth and I can have a currency, of course. But then once you get, it's almost like bad comparison, but when Jamie Dimon is critical of Bitcoin, I don't think it comes down to he thinks it's a Ponzi or it's a bubble. I think he just doesn't understand it. And I think once you get into Bitcoin and you start to understand it, what it means for you, then you get to the point where, like I did, where actually I could not support big blocks because you want to keep it decentralized. So, okay, that's really interesting. Okay.
Yeah, I mean, I've spent a lot of my time at BitGo actually writing software that parses the blockchain. Mm-hmm. And I've seen how over the years with you know, the Bitcoin blockchain at like 1 megabyte sizes can only increase by something like 50 gigabytes per year. But I've seen that even with that, over the years, I have struggled as an engineer at BitGo to continue refining my software to be able to scale and keep up with the data. Because when you're building a system or even just a full node that has to parse that entire blockchain, you know, every time you have to parse the entire blockchain and then you do it again later, it's just more work, and it keeps becoming more and more work over time because you're never deleting data or just adding more and more data. So while it might not seem like, you know, we're adding a lot of data, I take a very long-term view of this and say, well, what's it going to be like in 10 years or 20 years? And so I did have an article recently about like SPV scaling and general cost of running a full node where I tried to take the perspective of the big blockers and like do Visa scale transactions and figure out, you know, what is the cost of running a full node on this network that they are envisioning with zero fees and, you know, 1,000 transactions per second. And it very easily balloons out to, you know, server, you end up having like needing grids of server farms with thousands of hard drives, you know, in RAID arrays together.
So it can only be afforded by the corporations.
Yeah, and
who will then have control.
And people make fun of the Craig Wright quote, the $20,000 node or piss off quote. But like the numbers that I was coming up with were way more than $20,000.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
What do you make of that guy? I mean, I know you did, like, I haven't listened to it, but there's like an hour and a half interview with you about him or something on your website.
Yeah, and I met him at a conference and, you know, pretty personable guy. He has a bit different stage persona. He gets, you know, even more flamboyant. But in general, I think he's a good salesman. I'm not sure that he's like a good engineer. I'm still waiting to actually see any software get developed or produced by Inchain.
Why do you think he? Well, I'm not gonna say pretended because who knows. But
sure,
why do you
sure.
think he came out and said he was Satoshi?
So my understanding of like some of the things I've read and hearsay is that he somehow got into an agreement with Calvin Ayer, who was, I believe, a poker, online poker entrepreneur. I believe he's a billionaire. And it sounds like he somehow got into an agreement with Calvin Ayer to get a substantial sum of money, and that somehow the whole Satoshi Nakamoto and, you know, Tulip Trust coins was like a part of that, and that he had to convince Calvin for that, and now he's trying to convince other people. But I'm sure it all comes down to money.
But there's some quite key people in the history of Bitcoin who've come out and said they believe he is.
Yep.
And I don't understand that.
Well, and that's the whole bamboozled bit, right?
Yeah.
Of, you know, there are a few people that say that he signed a message with a Satoshi key. And then there's a lot of other evidence, actually, of him falsely signing things with a fake Satoshi key. I believe there was some evidence where, like, Greg Maxwell showed that he had, like, backdated some signatures or was using software that didn't even exist at the time. But I think the long story short is, like, there's a lot of really confusing stuff around here, but it's like Occam's razor, right? So if someone is Satoshi and they want to prove that they're Satoshi, there's zero need to have a private ceremony. The entire point of asymmetric cryptography is that you can use your private key to sign a message that you then release publicly to the world, mm-hmm. where anyone can validate it. So, you know, I would say any of us who are like deep in the technicals of this are not going to believe anyone's claim that they're Satoshi until they actually publicly release a message signed with a key that is known to have been like from an address or block, you know, mined by Satoshi back in the day.
All right, look, and a controversial kind of question. Is Satoshi even relevant anymore? In that, the reason I ask the question is, I often see an argument, Satoshi would have wanted this,
yeah.
and they cherry-pick parts of the white
Satoshi's
paper.
Satoshi's vision.
It's Satoshi's vision, but at the same time, it seems to me that Satoshi got a lot of help from other people. He didn't have all the answers. And also, by stepping out of it, he's no longer part of Bitcoin. He's chosen to not become part of it. So therefore, it's up to the people who are left doing it. So is he relevant anymore?
Not in terms of the future of Bitcoin. He is relevant in a historic context.
And a hero.
Yeah. And I cover that pretty well in my Nobody Understands Bitcoin article, where I actually went into a lot of detail where I showed the things that Satoshi got wrong and fixed. In those first couple of years, like, there were a lot of bugs, there were a lot of unintentional things in the software, and there was a lot of evidence that even Satoshi did not fully understand what they had built, and that other developers like Hal Finney and other of the early contributors came in and actually explained to Satoshi, like, this is actually what this, you know, piece of code does, we need to fix this. So this protocol is... it is organic. It is, you know, it's alive. It is going to continue to morph. And it will be affected by the ideology and skills and personalities of the people who decide to contribute to it.
Do you have any thoughts on who it is, or would you not even share it if you did?
No, I have no real thoughts. I mean, just for fun, the other day, I posted some anagrams of, Satoshi Nakamoto.
And what is it, the one, a man took a shit?
Yeah.
That cracked me up.
Or, you know, I am NSA, took oaths.
There's a Satan one as well, right?
Yeah. So, you know, sure, there are probably very few number of people who have the technical qualifications to build something like this, and they very well may be one or more of the, you know, well-known cypherpunks. That would be, like, top candidates. Or, you know, could be some folks in government intelligence agencies who do cryptography and this type of stuff.
I read a great conspiracy theory that it's the government and it's a way of clearing their debt, whereby there's the wallet with, what is it, like a million. Mm-hmm. So at the point where Bitcoin hits like $1 million dollars a coin, it will clear the national US debt. I don't believe it, but I thought it was a great conspiracy theory. Okay, so look, just going back, so we've got Bcash now. It exists, but there is still a war, and it still feels like that Bcash doesn't just want to exist on its own, but it actually, there are bad actors who want to try and destroy Bitcoin at the same time. Do you have any opinions on the price of Bcash and what's been happening, and manipulation and movement of money? Because there was at one point an inverse relationship, and it's not always there, but it felt like there was waves of selling of Bitcoin to buy Bcash to push the price up. And I'm a trader, right? I know you're not really a trader, but I'm a trader, and it became one of those very obvious pumps. Do you have thoughts about this?
Yeah, well, especially in the early days, there was an inverse relationship. So what was happening and what will happen with any of these altcoin airdrop forks is that as technically sophisticated holders get access to the money on the other chains, you know, as the software gets developed and released to allow them to do that, then the people who really care, and this is going to be like the fringe folks who are ideologically aligned with one side or the other, they're going to express their opinions on the market by dumping one side and exchanging it for the other side. The vast majority of people, from what I've seen, don't care. They're not aligned with one side or the other. And to be honest, from a investment standpoint, the conservative thing to do is nothing, and you hold both coins. And then if one of the coins goes to zero, then you're safe because you've got the other one. And, you know, presumably one would subsume the other, like the value would get sucked from one into another. And so, yeah, we saw some pretty coordinated pumps or trying to do the flippening of Bcash, which I profited off of pretty well. And I hope that they do a few more because I still have some of my Bcash left. But this is also one of the things I tweeted about where I said, so there are some trade-offs when you're doing these airdrop forks. One of the pros, and one of the reasons why I think they're becoming more prevalent, is that you can instantly overnight get a huge market cap. And it's a mostly fake market cap because, like I said, the vast majority of people don't even have access to their coins to sell them even if they wanted to. On the other hand, one of the cons to doing this is that you, in order to sustain your trading price, you have to pay what I was calling the exit tax, which means you're going to have to buy out everybody who is like completely against your fork and is going to dump all of their coins on that fork.
Which, and we've seen suspected large movements of Bitcoin from suspected Roger Ver wallets. So do you think he is having to pay to try and prop this up? And how much? I mean, it feels like he's missed the opportunity now. He had a few weeks to do it. Otherwise, it's kind of, I can't see Bitcoin coming back down now from like $12,500, $13,000 to be, I think that fight's over.
Yeah, I think there was some evidence showing that he was basically setting some big buy walls at like 0.1.
Yeah.
But then I think what we found happened, like during that time when people suspect that he sold a lot of his Bitcoins for Bcash, we later learned that there were some big like institutional investors that came in and just bought up a lot of Bitcoins. So, you know, that may be a transfer, you know, away from Roger to the next generation of Bitcoin holders, like the institutional level folks.
And it feels like now with Roger, he's kind of, I don't want to talk about him too much, and I'd actually like to meet him and talk to him, and sure. I'd happily have him on this, you know, but it feels like he's becoming more unstable publicly.
Yeah.
And he is talking a lot about money. So he's giving arguments about trying to help people who haven't got much money in developing countries.
Yeah.
And then almost gloating about sizes of wealth and money at the moment and becoming very unstable. Do you think this is affecting him?
Oh, yeah.
What do you think is going on here?
Yeah, I mean, this is just more frustration. You know, he has his vision for Bitcoin in the future, and so many people who are pushing back against that. And, you know, he's made some flubs, but really, like, this is one of the crazy things about this space is how popular some of us have become. And I think that Roger probably has like 200,000 Twitter followers, and like, there's nothing that can prepare you for that. And so sometimes he might say something that could have been phrased better. I know he said something the other day that could have been phrased better, and then he gets a lot of backlash for it. So I don't know, like, maybe if he doesn't have a PR agent, maybe he needs to invest some money in that, or just, you know, cool off on the public expression of some of these things and let other people take over.
You can stop the sentence before the word but.
Yes.
Yeah.
That's pretty cutting. Okay, so all right, so moving on for Bcash, we covered that. We then had the New York agreement, which seems very centralized way of coming to an agreement, which would lead to the acceptance. If we had SegWit, we would get the 2x. Following that, we had a cancellation of it. Mm-hmm. What's your kind of whole view on the whole thing that happened here, and your opinion on the New York agreement, the people behind it, and why ultimately it collapsed?
So the governance of this system, like we said, really hard to define. And what I think we're seeing happen, and this is not the first time that this has happened, is that people are experimenting with the system. They're poking the system. They're trying different tactics and then seeing how the system reacts. And so, you know, we had Bitcoin XT, Bitcoin Classic, Bitcoin Unlimited, then New York Agreement, SegWit2x. They're all trying similar but like slightly different variations, you know, to force contentious consensus changes to the network. And so far, those all failed. And then we had Bcash, which for all intents and purposes succeeded. So as soon as Bcash succeeded, 100 other people are copying that model because it was successful. So, you know, this is part of the freedom of the permissionless systems of you can do whatever you want. And people are going to fail a lot. And then when they succeed, other people are going to glom off of that success and try to duplicate that model.
Do you believe the lack of replay protection with SegWit2x was a direct attack on Bitcoin, but was ultimately their undoing because of the backlash from it?
Yeah, that was a really tricky problem. I mean, we had to spend weeks of engineering effort building our own like manual replay protection. And that was kind of one of the disappointing parts of SegWit2x getting called off, is we didn't get to use any of that. We still have the code. So if there is, you know, non-replay protected fork in the future, we're much more ready for it. And you could argue that that makes the ecosystem more robust as well, because lots of engineers throughout the ecosystem were working on building that type of functionality. But really, one of the reasons that I was disappointed about the falling apart is that I wanted to see the market speak. And, you know, I was ready to like dump all my SegWit2x coins. And,
well, I wanted to see the bet with Charlie Lee.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think everyone wanted to see that bet.
But, you know, that was one of the biggest, I would almost call it non-signals that was happening during the entire thing, is that once we got to somewhere between like 2 months to 1 month before SegWit2x was supposed to activate, I noticed that none of the 2x proponents were willing to put their money where their mouths were. And I was actively engaging people, trying to get them to do swaps with me.
I offered up Jeff Garzik.
Yeah.
And I didn't even think he'd respond to me because I had like 300 Twitter followers at the time. But anyway, he came back with a different argument. He said the reason for no replay protection was to protect thousands of different types of wallets.
Right. So the argument the argument was that because they were upgrading Bitcoin, you know, they weren't forking away from Bitcoin, because they were upgrading Bitcoin, if they added replay protection, then that would make all of the existing lightweight wallet software incompatible. So because they wanted to force everybody to be compatible with them, then it needed to be the exact same transaction format.
Right. And then no one would do any swaps. I offered him a swap.
Yeah.
Of course, he wouldn't do it. And then, so quite interestingly, I sold all my Bitcoin the night before it was cancelled.
Huh.
It was a really interesting coincidence. So as a trader, I'm always there's only two times I've ever sold all my Bitcoin. Once was during the Ethereum flipping in, mm-hmm. which worked out good for me. And I was in Vegas, and I was just getting annoyed with it all. And I could only see a scenario where the price would drop. So I sold everything, woke up in the morning, I saw it got cancelled, a scenario I hadn't seen, and then the price shot up. It's like, oh, shit. But then it dropped back down. So then it got cancelled. But then we go back to the point where the code was proved to have some fatal flaws in it. That could it have actually brought the network down? What would the scenario have been?
The network would have ground to a halt. There would have been no new blocks because there were some issues with the requirement for a block greater than 1 megabyte of size to be created at a certain height. And that was like part of the consensus rules. But then it was like the mining logic to create that block was not set correctly. And so the only way to get around that would have been to have manually set some different configurations in your node config file, which, of course, nobody would have done. So basically what would have happened was the whole network would have ground to a halt for a number of hours until people figured out, oh, wait, why aren't we creating any new blocks?
Has Jeff come out with a reason for why this happened?
I think he mostly tried to pawn it off as it was a problem where the block height that they had put in their like press releases did not match the logic of the code. Okay. But the short version is that the only way that it would have worked would have been if miners had manually updated config files, which, you know, no one ever expressed in any of the SegWit2x documentation that was going to be a requirement.
So this validates why Core is so good and why Core are needed for Bitcoin. And quite good timing then. So having been through all these challenges, I was with Bitcoin, I was also last night at your meetup where Jimmy Song presented about the three anti-fragilities of Bitcoin. So, which really covering why is Bitcoin so resilient? And do you think it will continue to be attacked, or do you think it's proven itself now?
Bitcoin needs to continue to be attacked in order to become more strong. But it's resilient. He went over a number of different reasons, but I think the simplest explanation is that it's resilient because of the people behind it. And while we might seem small compared to the rest of the world, there are many of us and we are very spread out. So there's no event that could happen that could make enough of us stop working on increasing the usability of the system. So as long as there are enough people who are devoted to continuing to improve the system, then it's okay if there is an event that causes something terrible to happen, because we'll just fix it and move forward. And, you know, nothing like that has happened since, I guess, 2013 or so. But there have been events in the past where there were bugs or inconsistencies found, and people grouped together and got them fixed within a matter of hours. And that will continue to be the case. And it, you know, may get fixed even faster these days now that there are so many more of us participating in the network.
How big do you think Bitcoin can get? And I mean, in terms of use case and price. I mean, because you seem to be in both camps of you care about it as a philosophical project, but you also care about wealth creation.
Yeah.
So I'm interested in both angles from you.
Yeah, so I believe that there is more value to be captured from the store of value use case. Of course, there are innumerable use cases to Bitcoin, especially when you start looking at it as not a money system or even a ledger, but when you just start looking at it as a database with interesting properties. So then you can start building all kinds of stuff on top of it. You know, even rare Pepes and Pepe Cash, and you know, there's really no limit to the possibilities.
Can we do Bitcoin kitties?
Absolutely, but they're going to be even more expensive than the crypto kitties on Ethereum. So I don't really see a ceiling for the price because there are so many different potential use cases that could happen. But you know, the simplest just being like replacing gold as a store of value, or replacing like sovereign monetary reserves. You know, there are, I don't even know how many trillions of dollars worth of like monetary reserves probably make more sense to be held in crypto asset type system rather than fiat. And of course, if that were to be the case, and Bitcoin didn't change at all from a technical standpoint, then the nature of Bitcoin might continue to change to the point at which, you know, it costs thousands of dollars to do a transaction on the network, but that all of the transactions that are happening are for millions of dollars or billions of dollars because it's like international, you know, settlement between nation states. So, I mean, that's one extreme possibility. But of course, we want for the average person to be able to access this system. Otherwise, it's not really empowering individuals to the extent that we want. So I definitely want to continue to see, you know, try to bring the cash-like properties back to the network, especially on these second layers and even third layers. There's no limit to the number of layers that might get created. So, you know, the only thing that I'm really sure of is that it's going to continue to evolve. It's going to continue to get weirder. But this is kind of like the state of the world itself, right? Everything keeps getting weirder as technological innovation continues to accelerate, you know, not just linear changes, but exponential changes.
Do you think we need a stable price and we will get to a stable price at some point? Or do you think it's not relevant?
Yeah, well, I mean, what is stability, right? So whenever someone talks about stability, they're really saying, will it be stable relative to some other asset? Because every yeah. price is relative. So, you know, are we going to get stability relative to the US dollar? Well, if Bitcoin really becomes mainstream, then the dollar might become volatile.
Well, I mean, some people argue the Bitcoin, one Bitcoin is still worth one Bitcoin.
Yep.
But the dollar price
is plummeting.
It's plummeting. But things in the shops aren't priced in Bitcoin yet.
Right.
So if they were, it would be. And I personally don't think we're going to get to a stage where, certainly, I had this argument on Twitter the other day, we're in leading economic powers. Bitcoin is going to, all cryptocurrencies are going to replace fiat. I think it's a symbiotic relationship. I can't see governments even allowing it because they will lose control. Do you think any nation states are actually investing in Bitcoin?
I don't know if nation states are, but, you know, we are seeing like sovereign wealth funds start to talk about it. So, you know, it started off with just individuals, you know, those crazy crypto anarchists. And then over the years, it's become, you know, high net worth individuals start to diversify into a little bit more. You have your small family offices, then your large family offices. And now it's, you know, Wall Street institutional investors, or even starting to see like national pension funds. I forget if it's like Sweden or Finland, you know, looking at putting, you know, a small percentage of their huge pension funds into crypto assets. And so eventually, you know, I think the IMF, the International Monetary Fund, has actually spoken about how, you know, it probably will make sense at some point for them to start holding crypto assets as part of their reserves. So it's not a huge leap from that standpoint to see, you know, smaller nation states, you know, those that have the least to lose by taking this risk. Because I think that the first nation state that does get into Bitcoin is going to have a huge first mover advantage, especially if there is then a cascade effect after that.
Yeah. And it's, I think this is, you know, we can see this happening because of the movements in price. I mean, I often get asked, Pete, what do you think the price is going to do? And you never know, but it keeps beating every single expectation, you know. So some people said 10,000 by the end of the year, but it looks like we could beat 15,000. You never know.
Yeah.
You know, somebody said 25 to 40 next year. We could be 60 to 80. We've no idea. But it feels like all the people with big money who are looking are thinking, shit, we need to get in quick. That said, what else do you think we need to happen with Bitcoin for it to integrate with the fabric of society and to become more mainstream? Because it is still quite complicated for the average person. I think the Cash App thing's cool.
Oh, yeah.
But what other things do you think need to happen to make it just become everyday?
Well, the biggest problem here is that this is a paradigm shift. So what we see happen a lot, like with the users that I interact with, is just people have become accustomed to having trusted third parties who will fix their fuck-ups. So this is a lesson in personal responsibility. And that is the question of, like, how long will it take for, you know, the culture to change its perspective of, you know, responsibility or financial responsibility? You know, that could take generations. So I would be afraid, you know, the technology might outpace the ability for society to actually keep up with it. You know, maybe in the interim, Bitcoin gets used more by machines, you know, setting up micropayment networks and, like, Internet of Things economy, that might go in that direction. But yes, this personal responsibility is very difficult to teach, though Bitcoin teaches harsh lessons to people every day, you know, who get into it without having the personal accountability that they probably should.
So do you think people should spend more time learning and understanding Bitcoin? And,
oh, yeah.
And what kind of things should they be learning? You know, I said to you, I'm a year in and I'm still learning. It's, you know, what kind of things should people be focusing on?
Well, there's just the general, you know, security practices and having good backups. So, you know, I have a ton of educational resources on my website.
Okay, I'm going to share that.
The biggest problem is just, you know, most people are not nerds. They don't have, like, IT practices at all. And I would argue that in general, everyone should have at least, you know, some amount of information technology understanding, because even if you're not into Bitcoin, most of our lives now are digital. And, like, you need to have, you know, backups and recovery mechanisms, because catastrophes happen, natural disasters happen. It's just, you know, if somebody's house burns down today, then they might lose their digital photos and videos and some stuff, but they're not going to lose all of their money, because their money is probably in a bank, not in a thumb drive under the mattress or something. So what we're really seeing these days is, like, I think the most losses that happen in Bitcoin are not people getting hacked. It's people who buy Bitcoin and put it on a computer or a paper wallet or something, forget about it for a few years, and then now what's happening a lot is they hear about the price and they say, oh, I've got some of that Bitcoin, and then they go try to recover it, and they discover that either they threw out the data or it got corrupted or any number of things happened to it, and now they lost everything.
Right, okay. And we've seen a growth in hardware wallets, which seem to have simplified the... Like, when I first started, people talk about paper wallets, cold wallets, and do you know what? It just seemed too weird and too scary. People said you should know your keys. And again, I've always felt that actually a hardware wallet just seems to be one of the safest routes. I mean, do you have views on hardware wallets? Do you have a preference what people should be doing?
Definitely. I tend to recommend Trezor and Ledger.
Yeah.
I'm a big fan of Ledger because they are supporting a number of different crypto assets. Yeah. So, and in fact, I had someone ask me this the other day. They said, you know, I'm just getting into the space and I'm buying all these tokens, but it's really hard to find a wallet that will hold all my stuff in one wallet. And I'm like, look, you're approaching this from the completely wrong standpoint. You are trying to trade security for convenience, because you're telling me you want to put all of your money into one piece of software created by, like, one or two developers, you know, where if there's a bug in that gets exploited, congratulations, you just lost all of your assets across all of the blockchains. So that's, like, the risk of centralization to a T right there.
Do you think there's a risk, though, if people start to hold significant amounts of wealth in their hardware wallets, if they're in their personal possession, in the future there's going to be a lot of reason to be coming to people's houses and attacking them and saying, give me a Trezor? Do you think this is a risk?
Yeah, we've only heard a few incidents of stuff like this happening, but it has already become an issue, especially if you're very public about being in this space. There have been a few people who have been kidnapped and, you know, basically tortured until they handed over their private keys. The only way around that from a technical standpoint is to not have direct access to your private keys. So, you know, I've written about this as well, of, you know, using multi-signature aspects to kind of split up your data amongst other like people in your family and friends. So you can actually create what I would say is better than bank level security if you're willing to put the effort into it. So the, you know, the problem now, you know, even if you, for example, have a bunch of private keys or a hardware wallet and you go like put that in a bank safety deposit box, you know, if the like access codes to get into that hardware wallet are also there, then that's still a single point of failure. You know, depending upon what your threat model is, if you're going like ultimate paranoia, you know, state level actor threat model, then you should assume that there's like no physical location that is safe. You know, agents are going to go into that bank, they're going to make them open up your deposit box, and they're going to take everything you have. The only way really around that is to split it up into many different locations and, you know, preferably encrypt it. I recommend using Shamir's secret sharing scheme, for example, so that it really becomes like a puzzle.
Okay, interesting. So there's the elephant in the room with regards to the environmental impact of Bitcoin. And I've had quite a few people turn to me and say, yeah, but Pete, this is terrible. Mm. Is this something that we're all kind of ignoring and trying to pretend isn't there? And should the community be looking at this?
I don't think it's being ignored. I think it's actually like a fundamental aspect of Bitcoin's security is that you need to make it extremely expensive for an attacker to be able to rewrite the history of the blockchain. And the way that we do that is that we make you prove that you have expended like a certain amount of energy in order to add data to the blockchain. So there are, you know, people who will say, oh, Bitcoin is using more electricity than Ireland or, you know, a small nation state or what have you. But from my experiences talking to a lot of miners, miners aren't going out there and like building electrical generation plants and like creating new electrical generation sources that didn't exist before. What they're doing is they're scouring the earth to find excess energy. And then they're building their mining facility next to wherever that excess energy is located.
Okay.
Like the only example that comes to mind, and I'm not even sure if they built the plant, but I know that there was some mining that was going on in Sweden where they were using like geothermal energy. And I'm not sure that that really even matters for the debate because, you know, that's not doing carbon emissions or really hurting the environment. Like geothermal is a renewable resource. You know, we're also seeing more people using some solar, but really mostly hydroelectric
power. Yeah, hydro is big.
Yeah, so, you know, hydroelectric power is like 24/7 as long as the water is there and tends to have a lot more excess energy. And so, especially in China and in the northwest of America, there's a lot of hydro energy that is extremely cheap because it's so plentiful.
Like Washington State.
Washington State, yeah. Yep. And so what the miners are doing is they're going and they're building their warehouses and stuffing them full of equipment as close to those hydroelectric plants as they can.
So I met a miner recently, a guy called Chad over in LA, and he's got a mining operation in Dallas. Mm-hmm. And I've decided to get involved in it with him. But the numbers we've actually started to look, you know, can we get a hydro dam? And it all seems a bit funny.
Ridiculous. Yeah, well, and I met someone locally just a few weeks ago who they did something even more innovative where they purchased a tire reprocessing facility.
I've read about this.
Yeah, he did a PR piece a week or two ago to...
Was this on your Twitter?
It. Yes.
Yes, that's where I saw it.
And so they had a plant that was already up and running, and they burn these old tires down and get the, you know, constituent petroleum and other byproducts, separate them out, sell those. But one of the interesting byproducts of this process is that it generates a lot of electricity. And originally, what they had been doing was selling it back to the power grid here in North Carolina for a few cents per kilowatt hour. And then they realized, we could be a lot more profitable if we just use that electricity ourselves to mine cryptocurrencies.
Oh, wow.
So that's what they've been doing. And so, you know, they didn't steal energy from anywhere. They were already creating the energy. They just sort of redirected it to a different use.
Okay, so I just wanted to ask you about a few other projects outside of Bitcoin, because we've talked a lot about Bitcoin, and I'm just going to name a few. And just can you just tell me what you think about them? And okay, so Litecoin.
Yeah, good project.
Good project.
I mean, you know, Charlie Lee is a pretty cool guy. He knows what he's doing. Now, it's kind of weird, you know, now that we have Bcash, it's like, you could basically, anything you can do with Bcash, you could do with Litecoin. Plus, Litecoin has higher rated witness, is going to have Lightning Network. Yeah, if you want to do cheaper, faster payments, I mean, I would use Litecoin instead of Bcash just for ideological reasons.
Dash.
That one, that's, you know, I've never really been a fan of Dash. My understanding is they've also got a huge pre-mine. All of the interactions I've had with Dash people have been like very marketing heavy.
Huge amount of their masternode, no, their mining rewards go back into the project to actually finance projects.
Yeah.
So they are treating it much more like a commercial project.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I'm not really heavy on the technical details there, though my understanding is that they're basically using, you know, a form of CoinJoin to, you know, give some privacy properties to the transactions, but it's still all in the clear. So unless they've got some like really innovative stuff coming down the pipeline, I know that they were doing some on-chain scaling stuff as well, which isn't that interesting, but you know, it's, there are other projects like Mimblewimble and Monero and Zcash.
So what's Mimblewimble?
So Mimblewimble is a completely new crypto asset that is using what I would call extreme on-chain privacy and extreme on-chain scaling.
Okay, so it's available now? People can use it?
It's a test network, just came out. I'm not sure when the production network is going to come out. Hopefully next year sometime. But Andrew Paulstra at Blockstream is one of the guys who's working on it. There's also several anonymous developers.
Okay.
And like Mimblewimble, I think, is one of the most promising new crypto asset projects that is out there, but it's very, very new. It's very cutting edge tech.
Okay. Monero.
Yeah, Monero.
Which I love, by the way.
No, I'm a big fan. Also, Ricardo, you know, Fluffy Pony, hilarious guy.
Yeah.
Also, good developer. They've got pretty good roadmap, and you know, they're putting releases out, and you know, they're hard forking every 6 months or so, but it's fine. It's like, it's part of their model. Like, everybody seems to agree to it. Doesn't seem to be contentious. They're going to have scaling issues. You know, Monero is less scalable on chain than Bitcoin, though. I think they might be looking at using bulletproofs and other stuff to help reduce the size of their transactions. But yeah, I mean, I think they have some pretty good engineering talent. They're going to continue. Monero probably is the best like privacy coin right now, because while you could argue that Zcash has more like academic privacy and it's shielded transactions, what really matters is whether people use it. And, you know, Monero ring signatures are on by default. Like, everybody's using them for every transaction. Zcash, only like 10 to 20% of transactions are actually using them. I was also seeing something recently, just the other day, that was showing that, you know, if you're shielding a transaction and then unshielding it not long after that, you can still, you know, there's still a lot of linkability going on. So Zcash, very interesting, but I think they have even more work to do to become like really strong privacy coin.
Okay, I had Zcash on my list. Got a few more. Ethereum.
Ethereum is just so different from a philosophical perspective from really mostly any of these other assets. You know, they've got the move fast and break things type approach. And with regard to the security model, they're also like more okay with using the like ask a friend security model. it's actually pretty hard to run a fully validating node on Ethereum that goes through the entire history of their blockchain. I've got an article that I've been working on for a while that I'll hopefully post soon about like all of the challenges that I've run into, because I've really spent about a year working on Ethereum infrastructure at BitGo. So we have an Ethereum product now, and it's been a challenge both at the very low level like node layer and also at the like smart contract layer. So I think I had some tweet where I quipped about, you know, cybersecurity is a nightmare. Crypto asset security is a super duper nightmare, but smart contract security is like a 1000x crazy nightmare on top of all these other things.
Do you know much about EOS, and is it a potential threat to Ethereum?
I don't know a lot about it, but it also seems to be mostly marketing and hype driven. I haven't really heard anybody say that they're like impressed with the technical aspects of it. But I know less about EOS than probably any of these other things. I haven't really spent any time looking at it from a technical standpoint.
IOTA?
Oh, God.
Yeah, because this one... I mean, you know, on a trader level, the prices have shot up. I've not bought it. I don't understand
it. Yeah, no, I've been watching it too. It's several $1 billion asset, which makes no sense.
It's fourth on market cap now.
Yeah. So IOTA is insane that it has gotten to where it is right now, because it's using, you know, this directed acyclic graph, which is not a very proven, like, secure data structure. But the more concerning thing about it is that, you know, it seems to be using some closed source coordination software that nobody actually knows how it works except for the developers behind it. And, you know, there was a lot of drama with some, I guess, exploits that were found. You know, they were like rolling their own crypto. But for me personally, I downloaded the IOTA source code because I noticed that it was written in Java, which, as far as I'm aware, none of these other crypto assets are written in Java. And I'm primarily a Java developer. So I was like, oh, this is cool. I might be able to actually, you know, read it and understand it. And I looked at their code base and I was like, this is a hot mess. Like, I would fire somebody who tried to, you know, write this type of code at BitGo. There's like no documentation. I could not, you know, read the code to understand what it was actually doing. And so as a result, I was like, I would never put any money in this because I can't understand it. It seems to be a miracle that it is working at all. But then again, you know, if it is essentially a like centralized data store, then, you know, anybody can do that. Okay. So we'll see. I would like to know, you know, what it actually costs to like run a node on the IOTA network, whether or not that's doing a full validation of their whole history, or if it's using snapshots of some sort. You know, I'm not even sure what the security model is. But the problem with a lot of these things is that they can be crappy. Like, they can have weak security models and, you know, be exploitable in different edge cases. But if they work most of the time, then sure, you know, they can get a fair amount of usage and a fair valuation until some catastrophe hits.
Well, the reason I'm asking this is, you know, however we feel philosophically about crypto assets, the majority of people putting in money in is for wealth creation, for an easier life, to be an early adopter, to see some kind of benefit. And now we're seeing hyper growth and hyper movements in price. My personal view is I'm putting the majority of money into the things I think will be here in 3 to 5 years that won't suddenly crash and be gone. And some of these projects I feel are potentially risky for people putting money in. They could lose a lot of money.
Yeah.
I've only got one left on that list, is Ripple.
Ah, well, that's a fun one because we have a Ripple wallet at BitGo. So I have experience, you know, running Ripple nodes and stuff like that. So Ripple is not particularly interesting to me because I just see it as a banking protocol. I've also had a number of issues running our Ripple nodes just from resource consumption. But, you know, they do a fair amount of transaction volume. You know, they've built a network. My understanding is, you know, they pre-mined a ton of XRP, and who knows how many billion dollars worth they have sitting in their Ripple bank, and they've been using that to create their network, you know, build banking relationships. So I suspect that Ripple is probably a pretty strong company, but note that I say Ripple is a pretty strong company.
Yeah.
Like, it is not a, like, as far as I am aware, it is not a decentralized open community project. It is mainly a company-driven banking protocol.
So it's not really a cryptocurrency?
I mean, you could argue, you know, it uses cryptographic, you know, aspects of it, but yeah, like, unless it kind of really goes back to what I originally said of, like, money is this concept that is open for humanity to decide, like, how to use. And my understanding of Ripple is that, you know, they have basically some sort of trusted or federated validator network where, like, if you want to be a validator node on the network that is basically being the workhorse for their consensus mechanism, then you have to get approved by them in order to do that. So it doesn't really fit my definition of, like, a sound money. Okay. I think that it can be a very successful banking protocol, but I would not, you know, store the vast majority of my wealth in that system.
Okay, you mentioned Mimblewimble.
Mimblewimble.
Sorry, I'll dig it out and put it in the show notes. Are there any other projects you think are really cool, that interesting tech that people should take a look at? You know, they could be coins out now. Anything else you think people should look at?
The main problem now is that the ecosystem is so large, and especially, you know, with the ICO token,
we didn't even cover that.
Yeah, is that, like, I can't even keep track of it, and, like, I get, you know, probably 10 emails a day of all these tokens and stuff, and I keep hitting unsubscribe, spam, unsubscribe. So, like, I'm trying not to keep up with it. It's even very hard. So, you know, I'm sure that there are a few, like, you know, gems out there in the rough, but there's also so many scams. Yeah. I'm really mostly concerned about Bitcoin, and trying to keep Bitcoin as kind of like a thought leader in the crypto asset space of, like, this is how you safely, you know, upgrade a permissionless system, that hopefully other permissionless systems will end up following.
Okay, and before we shoot off, good words, before we go off and shoot some guns, just final question. This has been great. Future for Bitcoin and future for you, you know, near and distant future, where do you think Bitcoin's going, and what about yourself and your interests?
Yeah, I mean, I think that for the near term future, we're going to see the most change come, you know, due to the institutional investments that are coming into the space. And, you know, that is going to continue to change use cases and nature of Bitcoin itself. But then I'm hoping that we can swing the pendulum back the other way in a number of facets. One, from, like, the mining standpoint, I want to see us, you know, re-decentralize mining. And two, from the, like, general user standpoint, I want to get us back to the point where Bitcoin actually becomes usable for, like, regular day-to-day payments and can really fulfill that promise of digital cash. But this is, you know, ground that no one has tread upon before. So there's so many unknown unknowns. It just comes down to, like, how does the community react to it? And you can kind of take a nihilistic point of view as well of, you know, if we agree that Bitcoin is going to continue to, you know, be in an adversarial environment and have to deal with all kinds of issues, then the outcome is binary. Either Bitcoin can overcome all of the issues that are faced with, or it can't. And I'm leaning towards the can side, because the number of people who are willing to fix issues continues to grow, and people, you know, become more invested, both from a financial standpoint, philosophical standpoint, what have you. So I think the main thing is just, you know, keep the network effect going, keep the ball rolling, not not be too worried about like what other people are doing. This whole flippening thing, I think, is so dumb. I mean, Ethereum should be Ethereum, Bitcoin should be Bitcoin, Bcash should be Bcash. Oh, and yes, I mean, there is some overlap of their, you know, competing in certain ways, but they can also, you know, be their own unique like ideology and personalities.
And for yourself?
So my goal has never really been, you know, Bitcoin. At a much higher level, my goal is to use my technical skills to empower individuals. And it just so happens that crypto assets are a really straightforward way of doing that. So I am interested in using my resources in any way possible to affect the lives of as many people around the world as possible, to give them more freedom and more power and the ability to interact globally, you know, whether it's like just communications or economically or what have you, you know, try to get the rest of the world plugged in to this new economy that we're building.
Great. Okay. That was amazing. Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
So what did you make of that? I hope you all enjoyed it. It was quite different from the previous two shows with Luke and Nick, but I hope you appreciate what I'm trying to do with this podcast in getting different people on, and I hope you took a lot from it. Jameson is just a really cool and interesting guy. He clearly loves Bitcoin. He clearly loves the community, and he wants to do everything he can to support it. I know we went into quite a bit of technical detail, and I don't understand it all myself, but I think it really is important when getting involved in crypto and Bitcoin and trading, we understand the tech. Especially, you know, when I was asking about specific coins, you know, he's raising things that kind of mean that some of these investments might not be as good as they appear because there might be issues with the tech. You know, and when we're investing in coins, it is important that we do our research and we invest in things that will grow, because there will come a time when the market dips and some of these projects might not exist. Some of these projects might not grow, or that we might actually lose money on them. So I suggest you go to the show notes, you go and look up Jameson's website, you follow him on Twitter, and you just start to get your head around the technical stuff. As I said at the start of the show, please do leave us a review on iTunes. It really, really does help. Please do follow me on social media and give me a shout if you have any questions. The website again is www.whatbitcoindid.com, and hopefully I'll have another show out for you next week. Okay, I hope you all have a great trading week, and I'll see you soon.